Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Ham Nation is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This episode of Ham Nation is brought to you by ICOM. For more information, visit ICOMAmerica.com/HamNation.
This is Ham Nation, episode number 206 for July 22nd, 2015. HOA 101. Hello, fellow hipsters and hamsters. It's time for Ham Nation. As you can tell, the grown-ups are away. we have no Bob tonight, and we have no Gordon. And in fact, we have no George, because George's internet went south on him. So it's the cool kids tonight. It's me. Well, at least when the other cool kid gets here, there'll be three of us, because I certainly am not. But we do have Val, and we have Dale. Val, how are you doing tonight, darling? You're looking lovely as always in your blue. Look, we almost even match in everything. We didn't plan that or
actually
anything.
It's black.
Well, it looks blue to me.
I'm doing much better. We had a flood, if you want to show that slide, Brian, right in the middle of the IARU HF Championship. This is what our ham shack looked like. It was seeping up through the floors. It was flooded. The whole town was flooded and closed off. I had to go to work by boat. It was pretty bad, but this happened right in the middle of the contest about 11 o'clock at night. But luckily, nothing got fried. So we're all dry now, though.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. That almost looks like South Louisiana weather during hurricanes and everything. So
it came out of nowhere. We got 4 inches of rain in less than an hour or so. So it just.
I don't care how good your drainage is. Nothing can keep up with that amount of rainfall. So nothing important got wet? No gear lost or any damage or anything?
No. Everything was salvaged because we were doing multi-singles. So there were four of us here on hand to quick get everything off the floor and get it all safe. So, yeah. And we were just sweeping out and sucking up water all night long till probably about 2:30 in the morning. So, yeah.
Good. Yeah. Awesome. Well, glad that worked out. Well, let's head over to Kansas, where it's probably hot and probably just as hot as it is here, but not nearly as humid. What's the weather like over by your place, Dale?
Actually, yesterday and today, not too bad, Don, but starting tomorrow, we're up around 98, 99, and it's going to stay that way. Speaking of numbers, we're at 114 of 157 WZOHQSL cards in the mail, so hope to knock that out here this evening and tomorrow evening, get that done. So Steve's done with his out W7H out in Washington. And wonder if you've been participating, haven't you, in that 100 Watts in a Wire Facebook group Christian started? That's something else. There's more activity on there than I've seen regarding amateur radio in a long time, Don. Go ahead.
It's amazing how that's taken off. Yeah, it seems to have hit a chord. People are digging it. And kudos to Christian and Katie Allen, WY7YL, for getting that off the ground. Yeah, they're doing a good job. Well, speaking of the weather, it's been brutally hot down here and humid as well. We weren't quite as hot today as we have been because we've had afternoon thundershowers the last couple of days. But I saw something on the weather the other day. I think it was last week that as of last week, there have been, I think, five or six days above 95 here. And one day, I think, that hit 100. And last year, we only had one day, I think, above 95 and no days that hit 100. So it's a brutal summer down here. I've heard of some of the pavement already buckling and cracking, which, you know, the interstate, you get that down here. And something else that I've seen, this apparently is a South Louisiana and South Mississippi problem. You have roadkill everywhere, but down here, you know, reptiles like to get on the hot pavement at night and warm themselves. I was driving to work to New Orleans the other morning, and I saw two dead alligators on the side of the road, anywhere from 3 to about 5 feet long. So,
wow.
Nighttime driving is can be hazardous. In fact, there was a wreck not too long ago. I think I'm trying to remember if there was a fatality in this or not. About 2 o'clock in the morning, a guy is driving down Interstate 10 through the swampy area of New Orleans East in a van, and he hit an alligator, ran over it, and disabled his vehicle. And I believe another car came along and rear-ended him. And I don't remember if there was a fatality or an injury. I know that the alligator succumbed. Obviously, but hit about a 4 or 5 foot alligator, and it's one of those things you've got to, you know, there's something no matter where you live, and down here we get alligators in the middle of the road. So anyway, that's just the way it goes. So okay, so we don't have Bob tonight because Bob is out actually performing an organ concert, which is kind of cool. And Gordo is at the Special Olympics, so he's operating over at Special Olympics. So we've got us tonight, to the three of us, and of course we'll have Amanda a little bit later on with your questions from the chat room. But let's just get right into it, why don't we, and get into Val's DX Corner. It's a lovely corner because Val's there.
You like my corner?
Love your corner.
I like my corner. Well, you know, I've been focusing a lot on logging software. Well, I wanted to kind of go over with you why you should actually get a logging software. So if you want to show that slide, Brian. You know, for those of you just starting off or just recently upgrading and getting onto HF, you're going to want to find a logging software. It helps keep track of who you've worked and when and where. It's so much better than paper logging. And you're going to keep track of who is QSL'd or confirmed. You're going to be able to track all the states you've worked, countries you've worked, grids and counties that you've worked. And most logging softwares are going to automatically upload to LOTW, EQSL, and Club Log. And even the deluxe versions, they're going to control your rig right from your computer, which is very nice. And a lot of them come with the spotting network integration. And some have CW and digital decoding capabilities. And some can even print the labels for your QSL cards. Saves you a lot of handwriting on your cards when you have to start sending cards out. And a lot of them have propagation charting and gray line maps. So if you need a certain country on a certain band, they're going to tell you when their gray line is or your gray line is and when it's best to try and get through and work those guys. And a lot of them interact with QRZ, giving you heading and distance. So there's really a lot of advantages to getting a logging software. And the earlier in your ham radio hobby that you get them, the better off you're going to be. So now I've already shown you Ham Radio Deluxe, and I've shown you N1MM Logger Plus along with DX Lab Suite. Well, there's a lot more out there for Windows, but here's a few of the other ones I looked up for you. Logger 32, that one's a general logging software. And there's XM Log, that's also a free logging software out there. And Write Log is a contest logging software that's out there as well. I'm going to have all these slides up on Wiki so you don't have to write any of this down. Now, for those of you out there that use a Mac, unfortunately, I don't use a Mac, so I couldn't really do a demo for you on Mac, but I did do a little research on that for you. And here seem to be the logging software that everybody seems to use for their Mac. Mac Logger DX seems to be sort of the Cadillac of them all, sort of like the HRD for Mac. There is a fee with that one. It's $95, but they have a lot of features, a lot of the same features you would probably see with HRD. There's also a really cool one, the Rum Log one. That one You can work your K3 or your KX3 right from your iPhone or your iPad. So you could be sipping a Mai Tai on your hammock in the yard while working DX. So I thought that was kind of a cool thing. Those are pretty cool to go check out if you have Mac or iPad or an iPhone, if you want to use your logging on that. Also, for you Linux users, I don't use Linux. I just use Windows for my operating system. But there are logging software out there, software packages out there for you guys as well that you can go check out. I'm pretty sure all of those are free because that's Linux, which is free. Everything's free. And for those of you who don't have your ticket but our shortwave listeners, there's actually logging software out there for you guys as well. So it pays to go out and test them out. Try a few out, see what you like. And a lot of them that you pay for have free 30-day trials. So hopefully this helps you decide which logging software to use. So also, I want to let you guys know I've been getting a lot of technical questions on some of the different logging software I was focusing on, and I will return your emails, I promise, just with the flooding. And I recently changed jobs. I'm working at a different radio station now in a bigger market, and so I've just had a lot of balls in the air, but I promise I will return your emails for those of you who sent me technical questions on different logging software features. So be patient on that. But I have a feeling my inbox may get a little heavy because Jerry and I have been kicking around this one idea to kind of offer up a mentorship. So if you, maybe you tried Field Day and really liked it and wanted to give a try at contesting, or maybe you're just new to the hobby and even just a technician and want to see what HF is all about, or I've always wanted to operate from a large station. And if you're looking for a contest mentor and you're available the weekend of August 15th through the 16th, and you can provide transportation down here on the farm to Crescent City, Illinois, well, then we want you. We're going to be opening up our station. We'll provide lodging, food, and beverage. And we're going to be operating multi-single for the NAQP, which is the North American CUSO Party. And by multi-single, that means we're just going to have one radio going, and it'll be just the three of us, Jerry, myself, and whoever we pick to come be our mentor that weekend. And don't be fearful. We're going to help you through it. We're all going to take turns in the chair. No one's going to be stuck in the chair for any lengthy period of time, but you'll get to hear how Jerry does things, how I do things, and we'll help you through it all and how to work all the beverages and everything we've got here. But we thought it would be kind of fun to open this up to anybody who was interested in looking at the contesting or taking it to the next level. So if you are, if you're available the weekend of August 15th and 16th, and you can provide your transportation here to Crescent City, Illinois, send me an email, nv9l@awrl.net, and I will pick the winner, I guess, if you want to call it that, to come that weekend and operate with us for NAQP. Now, I'm going to see if I can get on, even though I'm not supposed to be on next week. Hopefully, they'll let me on for a minute or so I can pick who the winner is. So email me within the next 7 days, before next Wednesday, and we'll pick somebody that can come out and play with us in NAQP. And hopefully, if we get a lot of response, maybe we'll do this more often for some more contests. So make sure you send me an email. And as far as DXing goes right now, not a lot going on. Again, like I said, it's summer. But we do have Dima. He is actually on Cocos Island right now. And that's TI-9. It's right by Costa Rica. TI-9 stroke Romeo Alpha 9 uniform, Sierra uniform. And he's only going to be there through Sunday. Now, he's helping out the park rangers upgrade their communication systems. And they're saying this could be the last time someone is going to be on Cocos Island for quite some time. So if you do need Cocos Island, you better get her done by Sunday, because he's only there through Sunday. And he's mostly only doing CW. I've not seen any RIDI or phone spots. I'm not even sure if he's got a microphone or RIDI capability there, but he is there for sure on CW. So make sure you try to get that guy in the log, because it could be quite some time before someone goes to Cocos Island. Now, I haven't done DX Code of Conduct for almost a year and a half, and so I figure a lot of you have maybe just gotten your license or recently upgraded and are operating on HF. And this is really the rule book for HF. And as a lot of you hear in those pileups, a lot more people need to learn about the DX Code of Conduct. This is your Bible for DXing. And I'm just going to kind of go over the main points. You know, first thing you do is listen, and listen again. Make sure you know what they're asking for, what they're looking for. Make sure you can hear him. You don't want to transmit. If you can't hear him, come back to your call. Only call him back if you can copy him. If you can't copy him, then don't be calling. Don't trust the cluster. Somebody could have just typed one letter wrong, and all of a sudden you think it's Chad Africa when it's, you know, some normal country or something. Don't interfere with the DX station. Never tune up on the DX frequency. Wait for the DX station to end their contact before you call them. So, and you may not hear who he's talking to. So you got to wait for him to call QRZ or say he's taking calls now. Always send your full call sign. Never send just the last three letters or something like that. The full call sign. You call and then you listen for a reasonable interval. Do not call your call sign over and over again. I hear guys out there, they'll say their call sign four times in a row and they miss the guy coming back to their call sign because they were too busy calling over and over and over. Don't transmit when the DX operator is asking for another call sign or when they're asking for a call sign that's not similar to yours or if they're asking for a call sign in a geographic region that's not yours. Now, like Amanda, she's a K-1. Even though she's out in Colorado. So when they're looking for ones, she would go, even though she's in Colorado. So you got to, when they're looking for ones and there's a one in your call, that's when you go. When they're looking for west of Mississippi, then Amanda would go on that. So as an example. And when the DX operator calls you, if he got your call sign right, do not give your call sign back to him yet, because especially on CW, you may have just confused him now. He got it right. Now you gave your call sign back, and now he thinks he may have gotten it wrong. And you might turn a 15-second QSO into a minute-long QSO, and three people now didn't get in the log. So, and be thankful when you make that contact, and be respectful of your fellow hams out there. So if everybody out there follows the DX Code of Conduct, those operators can move a lot faster and really have a chance to get everybody in the log. And that's all I've got for today. So I'm going to pass it over. We're going to, I think I smell some smoke and solder. So let's see what George has for smoke and solder.
I'm here with Vince, N5KQW, Wayne's brother from Field Day. And we're looking at a new antenna here that he just built. Vince, I don't think I've ever seen anything exactly like this. It looks like a couple of J-poles, but that's not what it is it?
No, it's basically just a dipole.
Or, I see that now, yeah. Maybe two dipoles, huh?
Could be two, yeah. It's got 70-centimeter elements here, and then the bottom ones are the 2-meter.
Let's take a little closer look. Tell us a little bit about how you made it.
Half-inch copper tubing, a couple of elbows, a couple of T's, and four half-inch end caps. Some steel band clamps here to clamp the shield and the center conductor down. I got lazy. I didn't feel like soldering it. So, yeah, I mean, that's pretty much it. I mean, it took me a couple of hours to do just because this was the first time I'd ever soldered copper pipe, and I actually had to learn how to do that.
It's a little harder than soldering wire, isn't it?
A little bit, yeah. There's a little technique to it. One of the techniques is that when you're soldering joints like this, you put flux on the pipe inside the 90, and then you heat up the back corner. You put the blue flame right there on the back corner, and then once it's hot enough, you hit the solder right there, and solder runs to heat. So it basically comes around and then goes back.
You just feed in the solder, it kind of goes where it needs to go.
Yep.
So it looks to me like it's two different elements here on the bottom. I'm assuming these are the two halves of a 2-meter dipole antenna.
Yep, that's it. They're 16 3/4 inches long. I made them a little bit longer because I got the lengthening and shortening of elements backwards, you know, for raising and lowering the frequency. And but it sort of worked out because when I bought the components for it, I ended up getting, I don't exactly know what these 90s are called, but the half-inch pipe goes in the other one, and this side of the pipe goes inside another, you know, half-inch receptacle. I meant to get two like that, yeah, with this end on either side, so I couldn't get the spacing apart the way the instructions said, so I just had to get it as far away from each other as I could and still leave me a little bit of room to solder. And they ended up being 0.91 and 0.92 distance. And keeping these things straight and level when you're heating up the solder joints when you don't have a proper jig to hold them is really difficult because all I had was a paper towel trying to hold this hot copper pipe and It wasn't pleasant.
So I'm assuming the end of this elbow here is just a little bit smaller than it really should be for that size of tee.
Yeah, it is. I just had to heat it up and keep sticking solder in it and hold it and have the solder try and fill it up a little bit and try and keep it spaced and lined up with the other element. And it was a lot harder to do.
So most people, for their first antenna, they build a quarter-wave ground plane using coat hangers. But this is your first antenna project, right?
Yeah, it is. I don't know why I chose this, but one day I was coming across surfing the internet and came across a design for a J-pole and then Slim Jims and thought, wow, that's a really good-looking antenna. You know, something drew me to it, and I've been looking at them ever since, and then I found this antenna.
It's at this link right here.
And I just decided it was built it because it was smaller. It was a dual band antenna. It was smaller than the standard 2-meter J-pole or Slim Jim. I really want to get a good look at, you know, how it performs.
So this is your first antenna, and you've been a ham how long?
Since either 86 or 87. I can't remember the exact year.
So you're a little overdue. I guess you need to build up several antennas now to catch up.
Yeah, I've currently got three more in the works.
Oh, wow. Well, let's take a look at it and see what it looks like on the analyzer. We'll zero in here on the frequency of the dip. Looks around 144 megahertz there, and it's moving. When I put my arm up here close to the antenna, we can see that dip's really moving around. I think we got a little problem.
Yeah, I think we do.
Well, I got some jumpers here. Let's just add a little coax to it. We've added about 12 feet of coax to it now and got the antenna analyzer and ourselves away from the antenna. This is looking much better here. 146.22 megahertz, 147.22. It is 1.1:1 right there. Very good looking.
Oh, thank you. Pretty good for my first try.
Yeah, very good for your first try. Most of us, we have to bend on those coat hangers a little bit and kind of hope to get them close. But, yeah, that looks to me like right about where you'd want a 2-meter antenna. It's a little higher down here at 145, but still, I mean, you know, 1.2:1. Let's check the UHF performance. We'll have to go for a different antenna analyzer now because this one will only go up to 180 megahertz. We pulled out the MFJ-266C here to measure UHF since my other analyzer wouldn't do it. Let's see, around 446 megahertz, we got a 1.5 VSWR. Let's see where that goes. If we decrease frequency, it starts going up. If we increase frequency, it starts going down. It gets down to 1.0, around 448. So as we go on 450 there, we start increasing. We've been testing on horizontally polarized. We just turned it up to vertical to see what it would do. It changed it a little bit, actually, down in the target area we were looking for. It's down around 1.1:1 now, so, hey, it looks even better in the position that you want to use it.
Yeah, it does. I don't know what we did to do that, but hopefully everything will be smooth if I ever decide to mount it somewhere.
Well, thanks for stopping by, Vince, and letting us check this thing out. Based on what we've seen here, I think you could have a winner there. Of course, getting it out and seeing how it works, it really is what matters.
Yeah, it is, and I have absolutely no place to put it.
Yeah, well, I guess you can pull it out and stick it up on a piece of PVC when you want to use it.
Oh, I'm looking forward to it.
Pretty cool stuff. The Woof Hong. And it looks like the old Wolf Hong. That's good stuff. Thanks, George. Well, we don't have a smoke and solder contest tonight because George was having internet problems, and I couldn't think of a question, and I don't have a prize to give away. So we will reprise that, put that on hold until next week. So, but anyway, fascinating stuff. Very good. That makes me want to go out and buy some copper tubing now. That's neat. All right, let's check in with Amateur Radio Newsline. Newsline is back, if you have not heard, which is good. This is in our second week of production, and we've got information on the Young Ham of the Year Award. And also, we have Dr. Tamitha with us tonight, so let's go ahead and get into Newsline. From Amateur Radio Newsline Report, number 1968, these are the Ham Nation headlines for Wednesday, July 22, 2015. The FCC has announced the closures of 11 field offices. The closures are in the cities of Anchorage, Buffalo, Detroit, Houston, Kansas City, Norfolk, Philadelphia, San Diego, San Juan, Seattle, and Tampa. This list is scaled back dramatically from the original plan to close nearly all of the FCC's field offices. It's a tough decision, said FCC Chairman Tom Wheeler. He continued, Congress has ordered that we spend less. We've been told to do with less. The numbers are out, and attendance at the 2015 Dayton Hamvention was up again. It's hard to argue with numbers, so the recent attendance report from the Dayton Hamvention held in May at the Hera Arena Complex certainly gives its sponsoring group some bragging rights. The official headcount of 25,621 released by the Dayton Amateur Radio Association is an increase of 748 attendees over last year and an impressive climb of 1,079 attendees over the 2013 event. Still, Hamvention's peak attendance was back in 1993 when 33,669 amateurs were on hand. After 1996, when the date of the annual event was changed from April to May, attendance varied from year to year. However, Dayton Hamvention has clearly grown in its profile as the world's largest gathering of hams and has become a magnet for amateur operators from around the globe. Mark your calendars. The date for Hamvention 2016 is May 20th to 22nd. And finally this week, Mark Abramovich, NT3V, got to break some good news to a deserving young ham. Let's listen in.
You're kidding, right? You're kidding?
No, I'm not. You are our choice.
Hey, Dad, did you hear that? I'm the winner.
That's Anna Veal, W0ANT, our newly minted Young Ham of the Year, in a phone conversation during which she learned she was the unanimous choice of our judging committee. Before we told Anna she was our winner, I asked what she would think if she was awarded the honor.
The hobby itself is just super fun, so I would just think of it as a huge honor and a fun opportunity.
Anna is 14. She'll turn 15 in August. She is the daughter of Paul Veal, N0AH, and Peggy Veal, KD0ISN, and lives in Littleton, Colorado. She has two sisters, fraternal twins. They are Claire and Leah, both 10. Anna holds a general class license. Her story of how she entered amateur radio is unique, but it had something to do with Dad.
Well, I was around 8 years old, and my sisters were at the time three. And so one day, my sisters and I were just downstairs in the basement messing around with my dad's Keir with zero power on. And he was talking to us about how he was going to be going to Dayton in a few months. And so I decided that it would be kind of fun if I got my license in Dayton. So I started studying then, and once we went to Dayton, I got it.
Even though she didn't have to, Anna decided to pursue learning Morse code, and while in fourth grade in 2010, decided to take and pass the general test and changed her call to the one she has now, W0ANT. It was back to Dayton in 2010 and an appearance at the Radio Club of America's Youth Forum. Anna attended Contest University in Dayton and earned an invitation to the TI-5 Youth DX Adventure Team.
So I went to Costa Rica when I was, I believe, 10 or 11 with a bunch of other kids. It was a really, really great trip. I was really interested. It was contesting at the time. I still am. It's just harder to get into contests with my busy schedule.
Anna earned the ARRL Rocky Mountain Division's Young Ham of the Year Award in 2011 for all of her achievements at such a young age. She credits her activity in ham radio with helping her to get into and succeed at the STEM school and academy.
Started out as me just wanting to mess around on my dad's Keir when I was 8, all the way to me giving presentations in Dayton, Ohio, and receiving awards, all the way to me going to Costa Rica. So amateur radio has given me a lot of opportunities, as well as led me to meet a lot of really nice people that I stay in touch with now. It's also kind of given me an open door to my school, because if I wasn't interested in amateur radio, I don't know if I would be going to the school I am now. Amateur radio has just given me a lot of opportunities and friends.
On behalf of the Young Ham of the Year Award Judging Committee, congratulations to Anna Veal, W0ANT. You can be sure Bill Pasternak, WA6ITF, who started this award and has since left us, would be proud of your achievement. For the Amateur Radio Newsline, I'm Mark Abramovich, NT3V, in Philadelphia.
There's lots more to Anna's story, and you can hear Mark's complete report in this week's Amateur Radio Newsline report. And hopefully we'll see you at the Huntsville Ham Fest in August for the award presentation. And that's all from the Amateur Radio Newsline, your independent source for amateur radio news for over 37 years and counting at www.arnewsline.org. For Mark Abramovich, NT3V, and Karen Eve Murray, KD2GUT at the news desk in New York, I'm Don Wilbanks, AE5DW. 73, we'll see you next time here on Ham Nation. And now, here's Dr. Tamitha Scove with the solar update.
Hi, I'm Tamitha Scove with your solar storm forecast for the week of July 22nd. The sun has been incredibly quiet this week. We've had very little in the way of flare activity. In fact, the solar flux levels have been very low. But we've had gorgeous prominence eruptions like the one right off the northeast limb that you saw here back on the 16th. And then back on the 19th, we had two of them. One came from the northwest limb. You can see it just beginning to erupt right there. Bam! That left off, and it missed us to the west. But then that started another one. Bam! You see it right there. That erupted just to the southwest of us, but it looks like there might actually be an earthward-directed component. Switching to our M-flare threat meter, you can see we've really flatlined when it comes to flares. We've stayed well below the seafloor, except for that B-class flare that happened on the 19th when those filaments erupted. But since then, we've flatlined again, and we will remain like that for at least another couple days until some new regions rotate around the east limb. Switching to your solar storm levels, you can see we've actually had quite a bit of activity, especially on the 13th when a glancing blow from a solar storm we expected to kind of miss us actually hit us a lot harder than we thought. But since then, things really died down. In fact, I was getting complaints over a few days that there wasn't even enough activity for ham radio operation. Now, remember that prominence eruption I talked about that might have an earthward component? Well, this is Enlil. This is NOAA's version of the model. The top panel's density, the bottom panel's velocity, and you can see that solar storm coming out, and it indeed is going west of us and south of us. But it looks like it might actually have a slight earthward component that will hit us. If it hits us at all, it'll hit us late into the 22nd, into the 23rd, so we might actually see some storming because of this. Switching to your solar storm conditions and aurora possibilities over the coming week, we are anticipating that glancing blow on the 23rd, so NOAA has given us a 45% chance of a major storm at high latitudes just for about a day with things beginning to calm down. At mid-latitudes, we're only expecting about a 10% chance of a minor storm with things calming down pretty quickly, because if we do see anything, it's probably going to be short-lived. But outside of that, things should calm down for the rest of the week. Switching to your solar flare and particle radiation storm outlook over the coming week, as I mentioned before, we do have a couple active regions that are in Earth view right now, but they are sleeping their way across the disk. So NOAA's giving us only about a 5% chance for an M-class flare over the coming week. In fact, solar flux levels are so low right now that you amateur radio operators should hope that that glancing solar storm blow actually stirs things up a little bit. Otherwise, you may have problems on the ham bands for the rest of the week. So this week looks to be, well, kind of sleepy. We are expecting that glancing blow from a solar storm on around the 23rd. The NASA model says no. The NOAA model says yes. So it's kind of one of those things where we're just hoping we catch the edge of it. If we do, we should have some decent aurora at high latitudes and maybe just a little bit of aurora at mid-latitudes for a short period of time before things calm back down again. Meanwhile, we don't really expect any M-class flares or any high-level flares at all, so you amateur radio operators may get a little frustrated because it's just too quiet for propagation right now. I'm sorry about that, but we should get something happening in the next few days as the new regions begin to rotate into Earth view. Thank you, Stereo, for letting us see those regions and the activity on the backside. So let's just hope that if we can hang out for a few more days, the sun will give us more opportunity. I'm Tamitha Scove. Thank you for watching.
ICOM America and ICOM Canada are teaming up to offer ham radio operators some incredible savings. Get a great deal on a D-Star repeater direct from ICOM and help expand D-Star across North America. With the release of the ID51A Plus and ID5100A, more people are getting on the air with D-Star. For a limited time, ICOM is offering a buy direct D-Star promotion for U.S. and Canadian residents only. Purchase a D-Star repeater through the D-Star Infrastructure Program. Visit ICOM America's website, view current amateur promotions, and buy direct. This promotion is good for a limited time only. Review complete instructions online and call or email in your order today. Visit icomamerica.com/amateur for more information on ICOM's BiDirect program.
Let me tell you something. If you're not playing with D-Star, you do not know what you're missing. You need to get in on the D-Star fun. And here's a cool way that you can perhaps do it and do it for free. Go to icomamerica.com/hamnation and register to win the weekly swag prizes and the weekly grand prize. Now, in July, it's an ID31. That is a 5-watt UHF D-Star transceiver. Of course, it's digital and analog. Has the new user interface packed into a slim, compact chassis. It's submersible. It's just the coolest little radio. You need to check that out. I've got the 51, which is the dual band version. This is the 31. It's 440 only, but it's a great, great radio and gets you on D-Star. And it's an amazing, amazing radio. So I want you to go to icomamerica.com/hamnation and register. You can register to win, like we said, for swag prizes, T-shirts, hats, all kinds of stuff. And every weekly drawing winner is automatically entered into the grand prize drawing. And again, that is the 31A. So maximize your chances of winning the grand prize every month at icomamerica.com/hamnation. ICOM, thank you so much for helping us do what we do here on Ham Nation. Now, why don't we get back into doing what we do? And let's do that with Dale. Dale, you've got some space weather stuff to talk about as well, I think, tonight, or one of your videos does anyway, huh?
Hey, we sure do, Don. Fantastic videos tonight. Two, in fact. One's a digest of how space weather affects the propagation in detail, and then the other is a positive way to deal with HOA restrictions. And both videos are long. We'll jump right in now with Dr. Tamitha Scove speaking at the Antenna Forum in Dayton. And this five-minute digest was prepared by our Ham Nation Wiki editor, Dan, N9LVS.
What is space weather? Well, essentially, space weather is a planet's interaction with its host star and the surrounding space environment. So let's get into what the star, our star, it's basically a giant fusion reactor that drives all of space weather. And because it's a big fusion reactor, we have energy output that comes in all kinds of forms. Because of all of this stuff, we have to stare at the sun in all different wavelengths, basically all different frequencies. It's kind of like looking at it from different frequencies of the ham bands. Every time we look at a different frequency, we're actually looking at a different temperature on the sun, and that translates to layers on the sun. This set of pictures, all the same moment in time. So that's not the only way we image space weather. We also look at coronagraphs. See that beautiful thing right there? That's a solar radiation storm. You think it only affects Earth, but it doesn't. It affects our space telescopes too. This is called the heliospheric imager, or HI. And so you're seeing all of this wispy stuff. These are coronal mass ejections. These are solar storms that are being blown off. Okay, so you'll see a solar flare along with a coronal mass ejection, boom, right there, and then you see this nice jet of plasma that comes out. Now, coronal mass ejections oftentimes happen at the same time as flares. Here's a perfect example. This is that one I showed you earlier. It's much more massive and much more slow, and it's got a loop shape because of the magnetic field. These are electrified, charged particles that are forced to be constrained and to move around the magnetic field. So the magnetic field of the sun dominates how these things move and where they're allowed to go. By the time these structures reach Earth, they are about a quarter of the distance between the sun and the Earth. That's how big these things are. Okay, these structures are the ones that cause geomagnetic storms. Speaking of, let's talk about the sun-Earth system. The near-Earth space environment is vast and complex, and the solar phenomena, they're just a first link in a very complex chain of events that lead to effects at the Earth. You know, most of you will recognize that I'm kind of talking about the ionosphere here. You've got the D region, E region, and F region. This is obviously an artistic diagram, but it's probably a little different than what you're used to. From the point of view of, you're not seeing smooth surfaces here. I purposely made these layers very warbly and to kind of give you a better idea of what's really happening. If you think almost like the surface of an ocean, you know, the ripples in the water, they're constantly changing. They're never the same, sometimes big, sometimes little. There are things like winds and waves and currents that are constantly moving. And this is the surface off of which your radio waves must propagate. It must bounce, reflect, and also all sorts of things can happen, as you can imagine. Anybody see, you know, you've ever been to look at the night sky and you ever see the stars twinkle? Like twinkle, twinkle, little star, and you wonder. That visual, you see how the light comes in and comes out and fades in and fades out? That is exactly, when you guys get signal fades, that's exactly what you're hearing. You're hearing twinkle, twinkle, little star. It's exactly the same thing. So I bet you'll never, now that you know that, I bet you'll never sing that song the same way again. So how does this affect the HF bands? Well, not just mentioning that ham radio was terrible, but how about this? Now, I'm sure some of you know DRAP. Color means bad on this map. This is a solar flare. This up here at the high poles, these are due to the particle radiation storms. Maybe even more. Even in this week cycle, we get them. Superstorms. How about this? This is March 6th through 15th, 1989. We had an X15 flare. The last slide was an X2. This is an X15. This was followed by a CME. So here is Enlil. Anybody who's seen my models or my videos knows this. The top panel's density, the bottom panel's velocity. You can see one solar storm coming out off to the west. Here's that second little guy. See him right there? So we have a potentially grazing blow from this solar storm. Amateur radio operators will be among the first to know on May 17th because you guys are the real space weather field reporters. Some parting thoughts. Amateur radio is affected by space weather every day. It's just like the weather in your own backyard. It's just a little further up. And there are a lot of misconceptions that exist. I mean, look at this to the left here. Say this, I mean, you guys know now, this is the BBC, right? A solar flare races towards Earth. If it does, it already hit. 8 minutes, people. And please come visit me on Space Weather TV, on Ham Nation. Tweet me on Twitter. I am very responsive. And you can also email me at spaceweatherwoman@gmail.com.
Well, thank you, Doctor, and we thank Dan for putting together the great digest. And you might want to go watch the entire 50-minute to one-hour forum there at the YouTube link you saw on the screen earlier. Well, next up, homeowners associations are nothing but problems for hams that want to get on the air, especially on HF, and especially with an effective signal. Well, Julian Frost, N3JF, and John Amadeo, NN6JA, the producer, by the way, of ABC's Last Man Standing, which starts its fifth season this fall, had a good friend in Florida that moved into one of those restricted communities. So from 3,000 miles away, they jumped in. They came up with a brilliant solution and a super video. And let's watch.
Hi, I'm Julian Frost, N3JF, and this is
Nancy Bennett, KK4WCC.
And we're in Stuart, Florida, where we're trying to get Nancy up on the air on HF. Unfortunately, Nancy lives in a community with incredible antenna restrictions. So we're going to show you how we get a huge antenna in a tiny little attic space and get Nancy up on HF. So follow us. Many of us know John Amadeo, NN6JA, as the producer of ABC's hit comedy Last Man Standing. You may also know that on Last Man Standing, Tim Allen plays Mike Baxter, who has the fictitious call KA0XTT. Tim Allen, the actor, is also a ham in real life, and the show uses real ham gear on the set, all of which is operational, including the antenna farm on the studio roof. John and Nancy have been friends for many years, and when Nancy got her technician ticket and then quickly upgraded to general, John was very happy that she had joined the great ham radio community. As hams, we all want the best antennas possible, but many of us live in antenna-restricted communities, and that was the problem Nancy was now facing. Her community in Stuart, southeastern Florida, is governed by a homeowners association. The streets are clean, the pond is filled with fish and concrete ducks, the lawns are beautifully manicured and are enjoyed by both the residents and the local wildlife. But as is typical with all HOAs, there are restrictions, lots of restrictions. Nancy, KK4WCC, has a nice little station consisting of an ICOM IC7100 with a Heil ICM microphone into a Daiwa CN801HP. She made several attempts to get permission from her homeowners association to put up a simple vertical antenna in her backyard. No luck. The homeowners association said no. No antennas of any kind, period. She was stuck. For the last man standing station, John selected a number of ComEd antennas for the stage roof. For VHF and UHF, they use GP1 and GP3 dual band verticals. And for HF, they use an H422 rotatable dipole. John commented that the Comet H422 works well right out of the box. And then he added, let's put a full-size H422 in Nancy's tiny attic. John and I both live on the West Coast, 2,300 miles from Nancy, a minor detail. The real problem was Nancy's attic. It's only 23 feet long and very cramped. The biggest problem, though, was the length of the H422. It's over 33 feet long. John came up with an idea. A cunning plan that could solve the problem. Rather than use the end 40-meter elements, we'd use the equivalent lengths of wire. In that way, we could arrange the wire at whatever angles necessary to fit the antenna in the cramped attic space. To tune the antenna, we knew we'd have to physically cut the aluminum tubing and shorten the sections. We modified the antenna in Los Angeles and shipped it, along with some coax, to Florida, where Daryl, KW4LG, did the initial install. The antenna just fit, with no room to spare. We did it. We got an antenna that's this big into a space this small. Daryl did an initial SWR sweep which showed promise on all of its four bands, although in each band its resonant frequency was low. The antenna would need tuning. Frequent flyer miles came to the rescue. John and I flew in from the West Coast and met with Nancy and Daryl, and we began a full day of antenna tuning. We ran 75 feet of new LMR400 from ABR Industries from the station to the antenna. After trimming the antenna's aluminum tubing and tweaking the lengths of wire at the insulators at both ends, we achieved some pretty respectable readings across the bands. Because the bandwidth was narrow, we added an LDG RT100 remote tuner at the feed point. Thanks to Daryl, Nancy already had an existing Comet dual-band VHF and UHF antenna in the attic for local repeater and D-Star use. John and I spent some time with Nancy showing her how to use all of her new gear. John showed Nancy how she could easily program her IC7100's memories using the programming software from RT Systems. Signals from all around the country were suddenly booming in. Almost as soon as we finished, Nancy was on the air, making contacts in Europe and beyond. Good luck, Radio 120 Echo. Echo, go to Radio 59.
Good luck, Joseph. Whiskey Charlie Charlie.
Before we left Florida, Nancy organized an eyeball QSO with members from several local amateur radio clubs. Over sandwiches and icy beverages, John spoke about how, along with Daryl's help, we transformed a once very limited station into one that's a joy to use.
Very strong signal. It's receiving like gangbusters. You can hear stations from all over the world. The first contact on that radio was Mexico, and the second contact was France. And it was 5-7, maybe. He was 20 over. You know, the people were coming in yesterday all day long, banging in on 20 and 40 meters.
I should have went on radio.
I mean, really, really, really strong signals.
To the other hams in the community, John explained how an antenna could be placed off the community grounds if you didn't mind pushing your luck with the homeowners association.
If you want to get into a battle with your homeowners association, you can just start pushing the envelope of that. You know, you just start putting up antennas and see how aggressive they are. Like, we think the preserve out there, which is not a part of this community, and they pay an association fee and they manage it, but inside that preserve is owned by the state. So technically, you could go back there and put a vertical.
Yeah.
Bury a coax, you know, make a little ditch witch, bury a coax, connect to it, and they could not say anything about it. Now, I'm sure you'd get into an argument with them about it, but you could do it.
They make all the state.
As for Nancy,
She is now happily working the world on HF.
Whiskey Charlie Charlie.
Not bad for an antenna crammed into an attic only 12 feet above the ground. What's more, there are no visible antennas on her house or in her backyard. She has a great station and no CCNR rules were broken. This was just one way to get on the air in an antenna-restricted community. If you find yourself in a similar situation, we encourage you to
never give up, never surrender.
Well, thanks, Julian, for that super video, and congratulations again to John, beginning his fifth season now, producing Last Man Standing. And we look forward to that show as it comes on again this fall with Tim on the radio every once in a while. Well, you've proven once again that hams can come up with very creative solutions. And the video also highlights the importance of supporting the ARRL in their efforts to get the Amateur Radio Parity Act, that's House Resolution 1301, and Senate Bill 1685 through Congress and into the law books. Find out what you should say to your congressman at ARRL.org, then write your congressman and write both senators. We get together, get enough people active, get enough co-sponsors, we can put an end to these organizations who work so hard to keep us from putting up powerful communication antennas. Well, coming up in the next video segment, we're going to do that graphical look at metadata from Ham Nation 200 special event. The data is going to be courtesy of Al, K1LTJ. We'll also have a report from Nick W5NSA from a big radio event in Poland. Well, we can use your video too and your shack photos. Get them to us soon. Email both the link to your video and shack photos to hamnationvideos@twit.tv. Let's switch studios now. Go out to Canyon City in neighboring Colorado and bring in Amanda, K1DDN. Take it away, Amanda.
Hey, thanks, Dale. And first of all, I just have a couple announcements to make. I know I've been kind of lacking on the announcements here, so there's just a few here for upgrades and new licensees. So without further ado, W7JKC John just passed his extra on Sunday. Congrats. Woo-hoo! There, John. All right. KM4IYQ Dudley says he upgraded to general last month. And woo-hoo! Also, we have a very proud grandpa here. WP2AHG Russ says that his 11-year-old granddaughter just got her technician license and so new she doesn't even have her license, her call sign license yet. But hey, congratulations to Sarah there. Woo-hoo! Good job. Cam.
That's right.
That is right. Now, I have something unusual that I've never heard of, Don. And you being a VE, I'm hoping you're going to be the expert on this. So you verify this. Okay. WB3BJU Don says that he, excuse me, he was going to a session for his general license. And he discovered since he was a technician prior to March 21st, 1987, the FCC will give credit for the general written exam. All I need to do is bring my current license proof I held the license before the date and have some forms filled out. I will now start studying for the extra license. Is that a true statement?
I believe that is a factual statement. I may be a little bit off on the dates, but yes, I believe that if Gordon was here, he could absolutely tell us whether that's true. But yes, I'm 99.9% sure that is true.
Well, hey, Don, other Don, not you, Don, because, you know. Whatever. Don, congrats that you're going to upgrade to general right away. And that you guys pay attention to that, because if you were a technician before then and passed the written exam, then that means that you're eligible for it as well. Yep. With that, I just have a couple of roundtable discussions I'd like to go over. The big topic for the night is tell me what I can buy of an HF rig that is economical and cheap for just getting into HF. So, Don, we talked to you already, so we're done. Val, can you...
We're done. Kick me to the curb.
We're over.
I'm used to being rejected. That's fine.
I feel like I've talked to you all day. Oh, wait, I did. Okay. Miss Valerie, what do you think? What are some good recommendations for just getting in, not even knowing if you're going to enjoy HF, but any good economical rigs there to go with?
Well, I bought used. I highly recommend starting off used so you can get a feel for it. And as you get into HF more, you're going to learn what you want more. If you want dual receive, you know, capabilities for, you know, two VFOs, things like that. But I started off with a 706 Mark IIG. I think I got it for $400. I had a station on the air for less than $600. The only thing new I had was coax. Everything else was, I had a used manual tuner with the alligator clips, and I had to re-solder a whole bunch of stuff to get it to work. And I used some speaker wire I had. So, I mean, you can get on the air pretty cheap when you're just starting off. And I highly recommend, other than your coax, going used until you decide then, save up for what you really want, what bells and whistles that turn you on. So that's what I have to say.
I echo that about the 706. That is a great, great radio. And what's cool about the 706 is it's a shack in a box because it's not just HF. It's HF plus 6 meter, plus 2 meter, and 440. Now, again, there's no tuner built into it. You have to have an external tuner. But that's a great radio. The first HF radio I ever had was an ICOM 738. It was 160 through 10. Did have an internal antenna tuner, and I used that radio forever. And then I got rid of that. I replaced it with an ICOM 746, which is another great radio. The 746 Pro is another really good used. It's an older ICOM, but again, a great radio. I had a TS-2000 for a while, Kenwood. That's a great radio. There's the ICOM, Kenwood, Yaesu. You're not going to go wrong with any of those. And there are a lot of older radios out there for really, really good prices. Like Val said, you don't have to buy new. The 706 Mark IIG, probably, arguably, the most popular ham radio ever made. And you cannot go wrong with that radio. Just make sure you get the Mark IIG. That's important.
Okay, Dale?
I agree all the way around about buying used. I would say visit your local candy store like the one we have here in the Wichita area. Tell them what you're looking for. For example, for years I had an ICOM 735. Now, those radios don't have the fancy DSP controls that we have today. But you could even put external controls on it, just monitoring the audio and changing its waveform. So a radio like that is not going to set you back too bad today. They are, 25 to 30 years old. So, but they're very good radios, and they are still good radios today. So I would say, visit your local store where the local Elmers hang out and get a radio of that vintage, the 80s and 90s. And then I would say also one of the things I would recommend is don't worry too much about the radio. If you're going to worry about something and put your biggest effort in something, put that in the antenna.
Yes.
Getting it up as high as you can and radiating as much of that signal from the lower power rigs that you can. So that's about it, Amanda.
Yes, and wire antennas. The beautiful thing about wire antennas is you don't have to put them up right. You just have to put them up. And that's all I've ever used are wire antennas, and I've talked around the world on wire antennas with 100 watts. So string up a wire. G5RV is a great starter antenna. Great starter antenna. It's only, 102 feet long?
And
there
get
you
them
go.
Up at the feed point as high as you can where the high yes. current area is, and they'll radiate real well.
Yeah, and that is all you need. I mean, I operated at an apartment building with a wire, and actually we had this really old Kenwood that used to drift off frequency all the time, and I was trying to get my Workdal States and the net control operators, because I was checking into Workdal States nets, and they were so nice in helping me say, okay, come back, lady. You're drifting off again. And people understand and they like to hear about your rigs on the air. So I say go with whatever is most convenient, cheapest for you to get on the air. And then you know what? Then you're going to realize that you could do so much better later on. And go to your field days. You'll learn a lot about different rigs there because everyone brings what they have. So I think that's this is all good advice, you guys. Thank you so much. And with that, you know, I didn't get a lot of other questions. We had a lot of discussion on chat about HF rigs, where to start, and also with HTs and where to start there. So we could go over that as well. What's a good all-around HT to start with? Don, I'll let you go first.
I started with a Yaesu FT530. Actually, no, I started this, 20 years ago with a Radio Shack HTX202. The Yaesu FT530 was the first dual band handy talkie that I ever bought. I've got an ICOM ID51 right now. It's a great radio, and if you want to get D-Star, you're not going to go wrong with that. That's for sure. The Kenwood THF6 is another great, great handy talkie. I've got one of those laying around here, sitting right over there. Great, great handy talkie. Highly recommend that radio as well. So, again, you're not going to go wrong with pretty much anything from Kenwood, ICOM, or Yaesu. I've got all three. Here's a VX. I don't have my glasses on. VX2, VX3, I think. Little tiny thing. It's kind of low on power, but it's a dual band handy talk. And if you've got repeaters nearby, that's a great choice as well. So any of the and Alinco makes some great handhelds as well. So, and of course, you can also go the Chinese route with the with those radios as well. So there's a plethora of them. I like a full featured radio, and again, that the ID51, that is my go-to radio right now.
There you go. And I just want to say something about the Chinese radios. Yes, they're absolutely awesome for your first radio, and even before you're licensed, a lot of people are buying them to listen to them, but oh my gosh, you guys, the audio on them is just not par to the other handhelds when you're talking on a repeater. Just going to put that out there. Yeah, it's
you kind of get what you pay for.
But hey, it will give you your first lessons on how to program a radio, because if you can program one of those, you will have no problem with anything.
That's exactly
else.
Right.
I promise you that. you'll be a stud at it. You guys, that's all I have. I'll send it back to you. You, Don, Val, Dale, thanks for your segments. Val, thank you so much for going over DX code of conduct again. That's really helpful to remind people of how to act in those DX pileups. I really appreciate it.
Well, thanks. And, you know, I want to let everybody know, too, I'm going to be presenting at the Hamfest in Piatone, August 2nd. So if anybody's in the Chicago area, it's just south of Chicago. Probably going to be talking about DXing and contesting. I really haven't done my plan yet, but I'll be there. I'll be presenting some kind of presentation for at that Hamfest. So come see me.
Great. And awesome. Don, you did your research, right? So you know what the net frequencies are?
I know that the 20-meter net, I saw it come across the chat room, is on 14270. I have not seen where the 40-meter net is, but the last one I had was around 7278 or so. If anyone knows different, Dale, do you know if that's still about the same?
I think it's the same. I've been listening. I haven't heard anything yet, but Al just tweeted a bit ago that he was getting ready for the net. So I'd check with 7278 and move up 5 or down 5 from there, and you'll probably find us without any trouble.
And if you just Google Ham Nation 40, you can go on and actually watch that stuff, watch the net operators go live video with that, which is kind of cool. Ham Nation 40, just Google that. Of course, Cheryl will be on 3847 as well, and the aforementioned D-Star. Reflector 14 Charlie, that should be going right now. And also Echolink on the Star Dewdrop In Star Conference node, conference server, that is node 355-800. So that will get you up and going on all of your nets. And of course, we can't forget Dan N5LVS with his great work on the wiki page, the Ham Nation wiki page. That's wiki.twit.tv/wiki/ham_nation. I know that went by pretty fast, but just Google Ham Nation Wiki, and I'm sure you'll find that. And, of course, you can send any questions to hamnation@twit.tv. So I think that will do it. For our absent friends tonight, that would be George, Gordon, and Bob. I think I speak for the room when I say 7-3, and thank you so much for allowing us to come into wherever it is that we come into to see you and have fun, and hopefully we educate each other about ham radio and the fun that we're having, and that's what it's all about, the fun and, of course, the community service and the emergency communication. So that's it. So thank you all so much, and we'll see you all next week here on Ham Nation. So good night, everybody.
Bye.